Welcome to the Mayo Clinic Ophthalmology Podcast on all things ophthalmology brought to you by Mayo Clinic. I'm your host, Dr. Andrea Tooley.
And I'm Dr. Eric Bothan. We're here to bring you the latest and greatest in ophthalmology, medicine, and more.
Dr. Ann Coleman joins us today to chat about her work in glaucoma, social determinants of health, big data, population studies, and being a leader in ophthalmology. Dr. Ann Coleman is the director of the Stein Eye Institute and chair of UCLA Department of Ophthalmology. She is a past AAO, AOS, and WIO president, elected member of the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. Coleman is an accomplished clinician scientist, having pioneered research in glaucoma drainage devices, and currently focuses her research on how social determinants of health and disparities relate to outcomes in glaucoma. Welcome, Dr. Coleman.
Well, thank you, Andrea.
We're thrilled to have you here, really.
Oh, thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. You're such a leader in medicine. You're a chair of a huge eye institute. You are a leader in amazing research for glaucoma. I'm really excited to talk with you about your work. I'd love for you to just share your journey. And you have kind of an interesting path. You had a PhD after your training and kind of how you got to where you got. Could you just take us through your path to how you got to be where you are today?
Well, in terms of my path, I got interested in medicine when I was very small. My father was a physician and all of his brothers were physicians. My grandfather was a physician in Virginia. And so I was exposed to medicine young. When I was thinking about going into healthcare, I told my mother I wanted to be a nurse. And she said, well, why not a doctor? And I was about three, and so I was like, yeah, why not a doctor?
Great.
And then I probably spent all my childhood trying to decide would I be a medical doctor or a doctor of science, a PhD. Mm. And so then when I did my undergraduate, I had opportunities to get a PhD in physiology because I was very interested in comparative physiology at the time, okay. But I decided to go to med school, and then I could always go back and do comparative physiology if I wanted to. So in med school, I just focused on medicine. They did have courses on epidemiology and biostatistics at the time, mm-hmm. But you know, we were so focused on learning about the individual patient that I really didn't appreciate the importance of population health and public health. And so that wasn't really until I went to Chicago for my residency at the University of Illinois. They did a lot of research. They had an epidemiologist on staff. Dr. Goldberg at the time, who was the chair, was very interested in hyphemas. So we were collecting a lot of data on hyphemas and hyphema management in the hospital. So then when I went to Hopkins, the Wilmer Eye Institute, for my fellowship, I realized that I kind of had a knack for epidemiology and statistics because I was trying to redesign all the studies. After having been an investigator with the hyphema, you know, I felt that the forms were too long. I thought that was too much work for the clinicians to do. And
right.
So I kind of got interested in studies under Al Sommer and Harry Quigley and Irv Pollack. So I then decided that I would go and get a master's in public health. And so I decided to choose my work where I was going to become faculty, where they had School of Public Health. Mm-hmm. So I could then get a master's of public health while on faculty. And so at UCLA, Roy Wilson was there and he had just finished his master's of public health while on faculty at UCLA. So that was one of the attractions to going on faculty at UCLA. So I planned to stay there 5 years because that's how long it takes to get invested in the pension. And then I was going to go back to Virginia. Needless to say, I never went back.
Right.
And then I converted the master's. After getting the master's, I decided to go ahead and get a doctorate. And that was important because at the time, a lot of my predecessors had master's. And so for me to be at the table, I really needed a doctorate, I felt. So that's how I approached it.
Fantastic. So I love hearing about people's different stories and how they're led in different ways and how sometimes your intentions and your plans don't end up panning out at all. And I think you've been able to build such a niche in your glaucoma work and really make a huge impact. And it's all because of these little steps and the training that you had along the way that really led you to that.
Right. Well, I've always believed in education. And so I think that education opens up doors and windows. Mm-hmm. And you might not necessarily go through them, but I think it gives you the opportunity if you want to. So that's how I've kind of approached it, is that when students ask me, I always encourage them that if they're thinking about a field, they should think about at least getting some schooling in it or a degree, because it's not necessarily the degree that makes the difference, but it's the interactions in the classroom and the schooling that creates the network and the connections. And that's really how you can move forward in a field.
So. That's fantastic advice. Oh, I love that. Now, we were so lucky for you to give us a great presentation this morning, and probably even more tonight, which I'm really excited about. But you spoke with us about your work this morning in social determinants of health related to glaucoma and outcomes for patients and disparities. And I mean, it was a very kind of robust presentation, kind of taking us through the whole kind of clinical story of how we started learning about social determinants of health. And you talked about how this really first came on the scene in the 70s, 80s, and then in the 90s, some kind of new ideas about how glaucoma can have disparate effects in different populations. Can you kind of talk to me and give me a little summary, even though I listened to your talk this morning again, about, you know, how did we initially learn this? Where did we start? And then where are we now with what we understand about glaucoma and social determinants of health?
Well, I think one of the things is that we were noticing differences in populations and epidemiology with work with Al Sommer and the Baltimore Eye Survey between the black population in the United States and Baltimore and the white population. And at the time, we were noticing these differences, but the question is why did the patients have these differences? Mm-hmm. And today we realize that it really is disparities in health and related to access. And this was one of the issues that we thought were important at the time. But at the time, people really weren't sure exactly what was happening in terms of people's risks. And so I think during the decades, we've been becoming more aware of the importance of social determinants of health. They've always been there, but I don't think they have been emphasized like they should have been. And really, society really hasn't addressed them like they should have been. I think when you look back at the research in the 90s, we were asking for policy changes. But it's very hard when policy changes are requested from ophthalmology. They really have to be done more through government and society and advocacy. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it's very important for us to become more advocates for our patients and also for society to really affect these disparities, because the disparities are where you grow up. That can cause regional differences. You can have different exposures to pollution. Also, who your parents are, what are their jobs in terms of their socioeconomic opportunities, mm-hmm. in terms of where you live. Do you live in a historically redlined district that's going to have a poor school structure and opportunities? And all of these things we're finding are actually really seriously impacting the health of the patients. And so it's really trying to address that and also to address racism, mm-hmm. In society, but also that's been present in medicine. So,
some of the fascinating things that you talked about this morning that really stuck with me in terms of glaucoma outcomes, when we're learning glaucoma, when we're studying, we all learn that glaucoma tends to affect those of African-American descent or Latina populations or Hispanic populations at higher percentages. But then you talked about surgical outcomes. You even talked about some of the microscopic cellular mechanisms that affect different patient populations. And take us through that. Just give us some of the initial rundown for someone listening who might not be aware of the complete level. It's not just that our black patients are getting glaucoma with higher frequency. Their surgical outcomes are less. And then the other interesting thing you said was about their awareness of the disease. And they might have, you said, EHR-only glaucoma, and they're not even aware they have it even though they've been diagnosed with it.
Right. So, well, that goes to the communication. And, you know, the issue is, as physicians, one of our biggest jobs is to educate our patients, mm-hmm. and their families. And a lot of times we think we've told them and they should hear it. And unfortunately, there can be a real disconnect between what we think we've said and what they think we've said. And you even have that with highly educated patients. I had a professor of epidemiology that I diagnosed with glaucoma. I gave her some eye drops. And then she came back a month later, and I'm like, well, how are the eye drops? She said, they were good. I finished them. I said, well, aren't you still taking them? She goes, no, I finished it. You know, and so here, there was a disconnect in the management of the disease. And this was with a professor. And so you can imagine how much of a disconnect there can be in terms of the how we present things, making assumptions where we shouldn't. You know, I assumed that she would know this was a chronic disease. You take medicines chronically. She didn't have that assumption. She thought I was curing her. And so I think it's really important to question how we're communicating with our patients to improve the education. In terms of what you were talking about, the biology, is one of the concepts that came out of UCLA in the 90s is the concept of weathering. And this is the issue of racism and also social economic disadvantage, how that biologically really affects individuals who have been subject to racism and also socioeconomic disadvantages and the stresses. And these stresses can lead to an inflammatory response. And so tying that into the failure of glaucoma surgery, in one study they found that they had increased fibroblasts in the conjunctiva of patients who were more likely to fail, and those tended to be more likely the black patients compared to the white patients. So it's something to be aware that when we're managing patients, they're not just coming to us de novo. They have all sorts of information that they're coming with, and also a lived life and generations of lived life that could really be affecting their responses to our treatments and also our diagnoses and how we manage them. So
I thought that concept of weathering you discussed was so interesting. It really adds another layer of complexity when you think about everything your patients are coming to you with, but the fact that the chronic stress just from the way they've had to live their life, where they grew up, who their parents were, what they went through growing up, could affect them on a biological level. Obviously, it makes sense, but we don't even think about it. Maybe they have more macrophages in their conjunctiva because they've been under chronic stress for their entire life, or maybe that's propagated in generation after generation. It's very interesting and a concept I've never heard of before.
Right. Yeah. It's not a new concept. It came out in the 90s, but like all knowledge, I was saying it takes at least 17, 18 years to get out into the community. And this concept is still a hypothesis. You know, they measure it with allostatic load. And so trying to do that in terms of looking at our patients in glaucoma. But it is a hypothesis that we're looking at because you do see it across many of the studies in the United States that our black patients have worse outcomes.
Right.
They are, even with the same access, sometimes they can have a worse outcome. And the question is why? Is it that there's racism in medicine and they're not getting the treatments that they should be getting? Or is it that because of this weathering process, they're already behind? And so we really have to modify how we manage them to help overcome that.
I think looking at this from all different angles, there's clearly not one answer.
Right.
So it makes sense to me to look at all the different angles going into it. You've been working on these types of projects for a long time. You are also a real leader in early studies using big data. And you've been talking about big data for a long time. Where are we now compared to 10 years ago with how we can use these types of databases and how we can implement this knowledge to help patients?
Oh, we're very far down the road.
Oh, good.
With big data, I think. You know, I think there's been a lot of great work coming out of the Mass Eye and Ear with Janie Wiggs and her group looking at the polygenic risk score. I think that's a use of big data and genetics. I also think that we're getting a lot of great work with Aaron Lee and Cecilia Lee with big data, using the IRIS registry, and then also with the Medicare claims data that we've been doing at UCLA, and also they've done it at Wilmer and Mass Eye and Ear. And so I think, you know, we're getting a lot of good information from our big data. I think it will be used to hopefully improve outcomes for patients. I think, though, that big data helps to direct where we go with our research and we go with our treatments and managements, but it's still, when you're meeting with that patient, it's still the individual patient. And so I think it's important to realize, as I tell my patients, I haven't met an average patient yet. You know, with big data and everything we do, we're always talking about averages, but there really is no average patient. It's very hard to find that person. And so you really do want to use that knowledge to help you approach your patients to give them the best care you can, but realizing that there is that individual there. And so you have to really tailor the treatment. And that's why we're trying to go to personalized medicine, and big data will help with that also. So
Yes. I think all these concepts, they keep coming up. We had Erin Lee on the podcast. Phenomenal work.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing. And all these concepts of big data, AI, tech, right. all this stuff. And ophthalmology is always on the forefront of tech, which right. I love that about Optho. Right. We have the best imaging, the best, coolest stuff. And so I love that we've been able to incorporate it, but it's a recurring theme. And right. so it really shows me that's where we're headed, because that's what all of the leaders and the trailblazers are doing in our space. And I really hope that it can improve outcomes for patients.
Well, that's the goal.
Yes.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. Yep. Another thing I'd love to pick your brain on, just the landscape of ophthalmology in general. You know, you have such a unique view, being past AAO president, AOS president, you're chair of a huge eye institute. You know, a lot of our listeners are private practice comprehensive ophthalmologists. Just in general, the landscape of ophthalmology from an academic institution, what pressures we're facing versus what private practice ophthalmologists are facing. I'd love to just hear your thoughts on kind of where we're headed as a specialty in general.
Well, I think we're lucky as a specialty because I think you have options. I think there are a lot of other specialties like orthopedics that you really have to function in a hospital and a health system. You know, we're lucky that we have graduates that have choice. They can go work for an HMO, or they can go work for private equity, or they can go open up their own right. practice in solo practice or in a small practice group, or they can go into academics. So we still have a lot of choice. And I think that's great because I think we have different personalities, we have different goals, different wishes. Mm-hmm. So I think because of that, ophthalmology is still such a great field to go into. I also think that with us being on the forefront of imaging and diagnosis, that helps us in terms of learning how to fit the physician role into AI and into machine learning. You know, where does the physician fit in that doctor-patient relationship mm-hmm. as we start getting AI making diagnoses? Mm-hmm. And if we get into robotic surgery, where do we fit into that? And so I think in ophthalmology, we're very fortunate that we have a lot of great thinkers as leaders at the academy and the different specialty societies, and I think they're going to help us navigate that. But I think it's most important to realize that at the center of it all is the physician-patient relationship. And I think that a lot of these tools will actually strengthen that if you know how to educate. Mm-hmm. And that comes back to where we started with, it's very important to educate those patients and not to make assumptions on what they know or don't know. So,
wise words. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. I appreciate it. This wonderful insight from you and amazing work. Thank you for helping your patients and for being here with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Coleman.
You can find all episodes of the Mayo Clinic Ophthalmology Podcast on our website.
Thank you for listening, and we definitely look forward to sharing more